Hi everyone, welcome back to the Internet Report, where we uncover what's working and what's breaking on the internet, and why. This week we're chatting about event IT and what it takes to deliver amazing digital experiences at major events such as concerts and conferences. We'll discuss best practices for picking the right technology solution for each unique environment, and takeaways IT ops teams at enterprise companies can apply to their own events and day-to-day operations. And we'll close with our usual roundup of recent outage events, including incidents at Azure, Microsoft 365, and Atlassian. I'm Barry Collins, and I'll be hosting today with Mike Hicks, Principal Solutions Analyst at Cisco Thousand Eyes. Also joining us this week is a very special guest, Dominic Hampton. Dominic is the Managing Director of Attend2 IT, a UK-based company that provides comprehensive IT services for events of all kinds, from music festivals to major corporate conferences. An IT industry veteran, Dom has more than two decades of experience in the space and has worked on events for many leading companies and organisations. As always, we've included chapters in the episode description below, so you can skip ahead to the sections that are most interesting to you. And if you haven't already, we'd love you to take a moment to give us a follow over at Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you like to listen. So let's dive right in. And Dom, tell us a bit more about what you do.
I'm Dom. I'm the Managing Director of Attend2 IT. We provide IT solutions across the festival, event, film and TV industries. We specialise in temporary installations. About 90%, maybe 95% of our work is temporary. Each year we work on over 200 events, including Brighton Pride, Great Escape, Secret Garden Party, and Gone Wild. It's another big one that we do. We're most known for our Wi-Fi, but the moment you've got an infrastructure in place, it's very easy to put CCTV on it, people counting, ticket scanning, that sort of stuff. But we do anything that's event IT orientated, so there's quite a lot of bespoke stuff that goes in.
So today we're focusing on all the connectivity considerations that go into events. You recently said that one size doesn't fit all in event connectivity. Just unpack that for us.
We're always looking for the silver bullet. We're always looking for something that's nice and easy to set up. But it just doesn't exist. You have to look at a varying number of factors. Cost is normally the largest, the time you've got to install, and the number of users you're going to have and what they're actually doing. Starlink is great if it's a small number of users. The reliability isn't massively key, and it's not an online gaming. Whilst you can use online gaming and various stuff over Starlink, if you're selling your game, that's not going to be an ideal connection. Conversely, we love to put in lease lines where we can, but some lease lines take 9 months to install, and some of the excess charges to get to some of the sites we're on are enormous. I think the most we've done where a client is accepted is 50,000, and it took 9 months to install. That was a ongoing process, a customer that we've had a lot of repeat business with, and that's the only way that's going to work. Whereas a lot of the time it's, can you install some Wi-Fi in 2 weeks' time? At which point your options are going to be much more limited. Certainly Starlink has improved that. We used to use, and we still use two-way, which is a nice system, but it's slow, it's relatively expensive, and it has to see a very particular part of the sky. And if you can't see that bit of the sky, it's not going to work. But again, that works quite well if you can see that bit of the sky and you can't see much of the rest of the sky, because Starlink needs to see even more of it. So yeah, it just depends on a huge number of factors in order to decide what connectivity you're going to be bringing to the site.
It's interesting that you're taking into consideration the cost plus the requirements and obviously your time to deliver on that, or how quickly you can get in there. But something you said there around the two-way from a satellite perspective there, you said it was slow. And you've also said you're matching different characteristics. So you can put CCTV on it, you can put all these things. Does that play a factor in terms of how you consider the characteristics of the application that matches a network, matches the business requirements, and then sort of tie it all together?
Yeah, hugely. I mean, CCTV we generally see as an internal network only. It's unusual for organisers to want to see it off-site. Some of the bigger shows we do, they will have Silver Command, which will be in a police station down the road, or in another building, at which case you've got some streaming that you're doing off-site, but actually the vast majority of it and the heavy lifting certainly is being done internally. With CCTV, it doesn't really matter if the image arrives 100 milliseconds later than it would do with a lease line. So CCTV is one of the easier ones, as are payment machines, because again, if you put a payment machine on and the payment takes 60 milliseconds longer to pay than it should do, no one's going to notice. But it's streaming, it's if we're doing demos for online gaming or any kind of release like that, where you're going to need to use those other connections. And it depends on the situation to what slow actually means. If you're doing PDQs, slow is 1 meg, 2 meg. If you're doing streaming, slow is 40, 50 meg. So again, it very much depends on the application and the quality. It's difficult to not sound flippant, but ultimately you have to say to the client, how important is this network? And sometimes it isn't that important and you can go for the cheaper options. And sometimes it has to be absolutely rock solid. Some of the product launches we do, they're staking their reputation on the stream. So they will say to us, you need to have 3 different internet connections, 3 different firewalls, 3 different switches. And then the streaming company, which generally, if it's that big, we wouldn't do, because it'll be a specialized streaming company that only does streaming. They'll have 3 of everything, because the cost of that going wrong, it will hit the press and be a nightmare.
So how does creating a network for a one-off event differ from building a network for, say, an office or another permanent site?
The easiest answer to that question is to show you our office network, because we've built it the way that we build our temporary networks. It's very ugly. There's cables running around the side of the room. There's gaffer tape. And that's the big difference, is that you've got to build that network in hours, not days. A lot of the time we'll use expensive point-to-point links, whereby if you're doing it permanently, you could just run a fiber, which is generally cheaper over that distance. One of the hardest things is that you never own the site. You're always working alongside all the other trades. And if the water company wants to drive their tractor over this bit of land, they will do. And if you plan to run a fiber down it, you've got to protect it. And you've no idea. It's too complicated to work out what every other trade is doing and what every other subcontractor is doing. You've just got to assume that if you put a cable down, unless it's in a very particular area, it's going to get driven over. So don't put the cable down.
So how do you go about that then? So you build redundancy upon redundancy upon redundancy because you've got a situation where it's got to be up?
Yeah. In the temporary world, you're measuring downtime in seconds. A bar dropping is going to lose you thousands per minute, if not tens of thousands per minute. So generally, we will run 2 routes to different locations. Quite often, if we've got a particularly busy gate, we will put a Starlink or a two-way on that gate, as well as the link back to the core network. So if the whole core network fails, there's still a Starlink there. There's still something. Won't be very fast, but it'll get you through. And that's a lot of our work.
Give us a couple of examples of the biggest or most complex events you've had to provide connectivity for.
One of my favourites is Brighton Pride. The nicest thing about it is all in one park. So we do Preston Park, which is the festival part of it. There's the parade first, and that finishes. And whereas with most festivals, you have dribs and drabs coming in over a few hours, what tends to happen at Pride is you get maybe 50 people, maybe 100 people turn up before the parade, and then everyone turns up at the same time. So it's quite frightening. If you've got any errors, you won't see them until the network gets stressed. And by the time the network gets stressed, it's too late. If you delay each person by 2 seconds, 3 seconds, you've got a queue that's going to be hours based on how that scales up.
So just to be clear, you're talking about entry here, the ticketed entry to events.
Yeah, that's the scanning, yeah. We do the scanning for that, but also we're providing the network for our own scanning solution. So all of that comes together. And if the network goes down, the scanners can't talk to each other and the fraud goes up, especially in the world where you print your own tickets. You know, that QR code is your only security, because the paper it's printed on belongs to the person who printed it, or it's even on their mobile phone. You've got no security there at all. Pride, we deploy probably 40, 50 CCTV cameras. I think there's over 100 access points on that show, but it's a huge show. And one of the nicest things for us is that the fiber that we've had installed comes into a building in the middle of the site with a lovely balcony that no one other than us gets access to. So we can walk around the balcony and see the show. It's fantastic. From a purely non-networking side, it's a good event to do as well. But it's quite a sprawling site. It's a park for the rest of the year. There's also a VIP area that's in a completely different, it's in a manor house that's adjoining, and there's that whole area to do. So the cable routes are interesting, and it's something that you learn over the years of where the ducting is and certain trees that have branches at the right height that you can string bits of cable through. And line of sight for wireless links is always very difficult. The chalet is surrounded by trees, but we know if we put stuff in certain places, we'll poke a hole through the trees. But it is a little bit worrying each time you go back, the trees have grown a little bit.
I was going to say, you know they grow, don't you? So it's going to get...
It's getting progressively harder. We now have... But what's nice is working with a... We like to build rapport with our customers, and repeat business is really important to us because we've been doing Pride since, I think, 2019. And each year we talk to them when we upgrade the site a little bit. We've now got a fibre that runs between the main stage and the chalet, which is where our servers live. And that means that when the trees grow, we're going to have less of a problem. We still back it up with a wireless link because there's, unfortunately, the council didn't put the fibre exactly where we wanted it. So there's still a fibre that goes from that cabinet to where we need it, which is at risk from people treading on it, walking on it, whatever. So we still do back it up with a wireless link because it's such a key link.
So do you also have to provide redundancy for power as well as connectivity on sites like that?
So power is handled almost always by a third party, and we do have to work very closely with the power companies. They will deploy for the traders, for the stages, and we try to tie in to work to build our distribution points where the traders will need their power. So we're not straining the power company to, you know, we don't want to be a thorn in their side. We're aware that we ask them for a lot. We always UPS core bits of the network, but the endpoints are generally just on the generators. And a show can be ruined by a bad power company or a bad relationship with a good power company. So that part of it is hugely important.
What if everything goes wrong, right? So you lose a network completely, you've lost your backup link. The fact you talked about having servers in there, so I'm assuming you have the capability to, in some instances, be able to sort of run almost autonomously. Yeah, you know, we've got power, so we can run Wi-Fi, so we have the access to the users within there, but we just can't get out from that site.
One of the big things is breaking down the network and going, who do we care about the most? And the most important is always the attendees. So control and CCTV is always the most important. So actually the internet at that point is actually irrelevant, other than the ability to be able to talk to Silver Command or police if there was some sort of incident. So they always will have some sort of backup, whether that's a Starlink, a two-way or whatever, and that will sit on its own UPS. And the power company will be the same. The power company will have the same responsibility. They'll know that control is very, very important. So they will put stuff in place to make sure there are two generator feeds or whatever they're going to do. InstaGrid is a fantastic product that's coming out that we're finding a lot on sites, which is a very large, rugged battery that it's basically UPS, but it works very, very well.
So you mentioned there, which is really interesting, about sort of personas in terms of the customers are important. There's the ones we talk about CCTV and all of that. When they're at these events, would you expect them to join your wireless to overcome things like sort of cell congestion? So if they're all joining the same mobile carrier, you got cell congestion, or do the carriers bring towers in, mobile 5G towers or whatever it is for that period?
So in the old days, the carriers would very much pay you to bring the towers in because then they could say that they've sponsored it or whatever. Then there was a period where they would sort of come in for free, and now they expect you to pay them. Generally, it depends on the event. They certainly want a sponsorship deal out of it, certainly want something for it. We often get asked for guest Wi-Fi, and then people realize the cost of it. And it depends where it is. We tend to do hotspots where we can, but then you have to be very careful that it just doesn't get, from a people point of view, as well as a congestion point of view, that you're essentially making a denial of service attack on your own, on one access point. Or two access points for wherever you've decided to do your hotspot. So you need to make sure that hotspot is miles away from any traders or anything important, just so that if it does get absolutely flooded, the key people are looked after. It's quite good to put it in VIP because then at least it's controlled and the numbers are slightly more sensible to look at. But obviously any kind of guest network is going to need a fiber. Well, it depends on the size of the event, of course, but it will probably need a fiber connection, which suddenly rules out half of the jobs that we do because you just can't get fiber to do them sensibly. And then there's the cost of the additional infrastructure. We've got a few events where they are sort of higher-end festivals where you can book a massage or a spa or whatever. So it's then within the festival's interest to get you online. So you'll tend to see it in the campsite. But then you've got to be really careful because if you put it in the campsite, you're opening yourself up to Netflix and Amazon Prime, and your bandwidth requirements go up. So you've got to be quite careful where you're going to put it, who's going to pay for it, and why you're actually doing it. Most people will be able to post on Facebook, because they'll post it on Facebook, the app holds onto it, and then 2 hours, 3 hours later, it might actually post it. And then you've got what you need anyway. So yeah, guest Wi-Fi is often asked for, but when you actually drill down and talk a client through it, most of them don't end up going for it.
Which comes back again to requirements, designing for the requirements, and then this is what we need. So yeah.
What other IT best practices do you keep in mind for events to help ensure everyone has the best possible experience?
I think the biggest thing is getting the brief right. The amount of times people come to us and say, well, I need a quote for 5 access points. Why do you need a quote for 5 access points? You need a quote to provide Wi-Fi in a space for a certain number of people. You've no idea what the access points are. I mean, generally at that point, it's because they've gone to another provider who's quoted them a price and they want light for light. But it's odd. In a lot of other industries, you'll say, I want you to build me a house. And this is the plan of the house. You don't go, I'm going to need 20 bits of wood and some bricks and some laborers for 10 days when you go to multiple contractors or multiple firms. But for some reason, that seems to happen quite a lot in the Wi-Fi business. So the biggest thing is get the brief right. Work out who your important clients are or the people using the service are going to be and why they need to use it. And if there is any way of offloading them, then offload them. We spend an awful lot of time trying to convince people not to use the wireless network that we're putting out. Because the less people that don't need to use it, the better it is for the people that do need to use it. And that's hugely important. And the other thing is just get on with everybody on site.
How much testing do you actually do on site?
Not a lot. The testing is very much done by the clients. We over-design our networks. We very rarely, if ever, do Wi-Fi surveys because there's no point. The ground is changing so quickly. The rooms are changing so fast. The Wi-Fi survey that you do 3 weeks out will be of a feel with a cow in it, not with with all the marquees and other infrastructure. So the best way that we find is we look at the zone directors, look at the controllers and look at what experience people are getting in a live environment and react because you could test it in the morning and someone builds a marquee in the middle of the day that you weren't expecting. And all of a sudden that whole area has got a completely different pattern. You know, marquees are great Faraday cages. They're the very definition of metal meshes. So well, some of them are, some of them aren't. Some of them are made out of plastic. So again, you can look at a plan all day long and go, oh, there's a marquee there, but are you really going to phone every single company and go, what's your marquee made out of? So you just have to go, fine, we'll put a AP in every single marquee as a minimum, at which point you don't need to worry about it so much. And I think that's quite a big difference between us and a permanent company because that's very wasteful if you're buying the access points. And therefore, I can see that a survey is definitely worth it. But if you're renting them and you've no idea what's going on in between, it's the only thing you can do, really.
There's a couple of things you said there which are really interesting there. So you're designing for outcomes and you're living in this dynamic world. So where we can take this information. And I think when we were talking before, you mentioned about always having to watch this stuff. So I've got to watch it all the time because, as you said, everything's changing. So you can't afford, and depending which service we're talking about, you know, we're talking seconds or people can't get through the gates, so we have to react quickly. So effectively, you've got eyes watching this all the time.
Yeah, we have some of the inbuilt software that the vendors that we use provide is just not quick enough. It waits 5 minutes before it tells you an access point's gone offline. Because it assumes that's okay or it's missed a heartbeat and it's not a problem. 5 minutes can lose you 10 grand on a bar. So very much that's not good enough. Which is why on a bar, even a small one, we'll put 2 access points out because if one decides to reboot, everything will jump onto the other one.
So it seems your biggest contingency is redundancy, making sure that everything is oversupplied, if you like.
Yes, everything is very, very deliberately over-engineered. And that's maybe why we're not the cheapest provider. But we do like to think ourselves as one of the most reliable. And that's not a flippant thing for clients. You know, if a client, it brings back to what I said earlier, if the network's not important, then don't spend the money on it and we can scale it back. But it's making sure that the client understands what that means and whether a network isn't important. We know of some organizations which quite cleverly with their PDQ machines, they run them in risk mode, which means if they can't contact the banks, they'll take the payment anyway, hold on to it, process it as long as the PIN number's right or the whatever security checks they can do without the internet work. And they'll tell them that, yeah, you can serve them that bit. And the risk is essentially that if that bar went down for 5 minutes, they'd lose 10 grand. If during that time five people couldn't actually pay for the beer, they'll lose 50 quid. So it makes a huge amount of sense to do it that way.
What lessons can enterprises learn from the principles of a successful major event? Or do you have any takeaways that they can apply to their daily operations?
We talked about you watching everything. You've got to watch it because there's 5 minutes there. Obviously, you can do that because you've got a set period of time when the event's on or when the system's on, or even if it's a production environment, you've got maybe 9 months where there's still a set period of time. If we're going to scale that up into an enterprise environment, they've effectively got to be able to do the same. But that becomes then ineffective to be able to have thousands of your employees, as much as you probably like it, sort of looking at all these environments all the same. So there's got to be a way of actually doing that. And I think that's the type of thing, or a great lesson to take, is to make this thing efficient, living in a dynamic world, is to take that and how can I scale that, your organization, how can I scale it to be able to look holistically across effectively the internet when I'm talking about the enterprise environments?
For our TVs and film studios, that's probably the middle ground, is that they are not monitored the same way the festival sites are monitored. They are more permanent infrastructure. We call them temporary because each 3, 4, 5, 6 months, a different production comes in and they'll put different cabins in and the space will very much evolve. But we couldn't be watching them 24/7. We couldn't be making sure that every single access point is up, and we're much more reactive to the studios. Mm-hmm. We have the alarms that go off. We will get an email if a UPS loses power or an access point goes off, but they tend to be sort of 5 minutes after the event's happened. But then that's the need, is that the studios generally don't mind if something goes offline for a short period of time. Depends. If it's in one of the stages and they're filming, then that can be an issue. But to be fair, at that point, you don't need to be reactive, because the moment it breaks, you'll get a phone call. You just need to be able to fix it while they're on the phone. We have never once said, can you please send in a ticket? That just doesn't work in our world, because even in the TV world, they need it instantly. Whereas I think in the enterprise world, because you've got to scale, and this isn't a criticism, it is very much your point, is that you can't scale the way that we do it without having vast numbers of staff looking at a huge number of monitors, just waiting for something to go wrong. It'd be great if someone wants to employ me to do that, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Thanks to Dom for that fascinating insight into managing live events. Now let's move on to our outage roundup. And Mike, there was an incident with Azure on January the 8th. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this happened around sort of 4:30 UTC. Started on January 8th and actually went through till January 11th. Now, this wasn't a consistent outage. It's caused intermittent failures where it caused connection drops, resource allocation failures, and it's affected multiple Azure services. It was within a single availability zone, and this was in US East 2. This is on the publication subscription service again. So this is that real-time communication between the servers that we talked about in a previous podcast. But this time it was on the Azure service itself. So in this time, it was actually affecting that communication, the configuration essentially between the virtual machines. So this sort of linking the address and the configurations, everything together. Now, what actually happened there was a manual restart of the internal PubSub replicas because they were trying to sort of do a flag update. So a flag and a feature flag. Sort of change something on there. Now, normally you'd sort of bring these down and take them up individually, but all of them are rebooted at the same time. And what happened then was actually destroy the indexing on the systems themselves. So these were partitioned so we could actually make queries to them and get the information quickly out from there. But the fact they all came back up at the same time caused this problem. They lost the indexing. So the network settings couldn't actually be sent to the agency control plane. So it impacted all the management operations for the resources. What they did, what Microsoft did to actually sort of get around this, is they sort of directed the affected host machines to connect to a different PubSub endpoint, which was in an unaffected availability zone, and then they were able to sort of bring the systems up.
There was a second Microsoft issue on January the 13th, a Microsoft 365 disruption. What went on here?
So this occurred around 10:33 a.m. UTC and then encountered an issue where it impacted the multi-factor authentication. So this is where you have that 2x authentication. So I log on, then I need some sort of other check to sort of verify my access there. It impacted some of the Microsoft 365 applications that were used and these users that needed to authenticate to the multi-factor authentication. They also experienced some challenges when they were trying to register and sort of reset process. So it's sort of everything from there. Again, what happened? So we're thinking about this where we could get to the front end system, we could actually log on to us, or we could attempt to log on to a system, and then was challenged again. So straight away, that tells us no network issue. when it was identified by Microsoft themselves, and it initially appeared to be impacting sort of Western Europe. What they did again, similar to where we had the redirection, they pushed it to a different authentication service or different multi-factor authentication services. And then systems started to respond and people were actually able to access the system. They then went through a period where they monitored it to make sure everything was stable. But again, we're looking very much at a back-end system failure where we could actually get to it. We could start to log on, but it was that second authentication system where the issue manifested itself.
On January the 22nd, Atlassian experienced an outage.
Yeah, this was occurred around sort of 15:30, and it's in what's Atlassian's Bitbucket, their cloud service itself. So it experienced an outage. It impacted the not the Atlassian website, but the Atlassian Bitbucket cloud website. They identified the root cause reasonably quickly. They were seeing a number of API errors, and they were able to identify what went on from there and then be able to take corrective measures based on that. What they said, what Atlassian came out with their official statement, is they were looking into it, and they said that the Bitbucket database itself was saturated. So this was then blocking all operations to the Bitbucket. So effectively then what you're thinking about is the core into a pint pot. We had this bottleneck, but the database couldn't actually process anything itself. So the types of systems this can then impact, or the things this can impact then, we're talking about effectively database contention. So, you know, this can be on sort of high traffic loads. We've got no reason to suspect the traffic increase. So it might have been some sort of cascading event that took place around there that caused this. And it sort of went into this system where we had this database saturated itself. The thing this could start to do, and we sort of saw some anecdotal evidence around this, is that if you're relying on a single instance for your code management, so you had all your code in the Bitbucket itself, what you could actually do then, if we're pushing out a patch or you want to do an update or you want to sort of release another branch of the code there, you couldn't actually do this or roll back from an error. So this could have actually caused other issues where not directly by yourselves, but where you have your code stored there, where you then can't sort of roll it out across there. So, you know, this is, you know, maybe an idea where we think about redundancies and start to come in that way there. So by looking at the nature of the outage, it sort of identified potential for single point of failures if I had all my eggs in one basket, so to speak. So this opens up some opportunity, say, for redundancy.
And finally, we've seen TikTok take itself out of service in the US, only to bring itself back online. What are your observations around this one, Mike?
This is interesting. And as you say, this was a shutdown of the service themselves, obviously sort of in light of some of the laws that were passed in the US. So the outage was first sort of noticed around 3:30 UTC. Obviously, we knew the cause of it. But what was interesting was the way they took themselves out of service. So when we actually looked at it from the test, starting around 3:30 UTC, what we started to see was redirection to a different landing page. This was a specifically US landing page. Then if we look at some of the JavaScript that's going into there, what we identified was they started to put sort of geo-blocking in there. Then the next stage to that was they actually revoked their DNS. So they said this TikTok.com effectively is not available. It's nowhere around the service. And then we saw it completely unavailable. So even if I was outside the US or going to the US where I was looking for that name resolving in the US, I couldn't have actually got to it. If you looked at the network path, it was failing at that DNS layer. It couldn't get there. Now, what was interesting about this was then when it started to come back again, we saw a complete reversal. So obviously the DNS was actually added back in again, and then we saw the landing page come in. But this time the landing page was active. So it went to US landing page. It was no longer doing the geo-blocking. What it was doing was actually serving that, identifying these systems. And it was way effective bringing the stuff back online. This sort of came around a couple of years ago where there was talk about blocking or stopping TikTok in environments. And there was ways of actually discussing and looking about how they could stop sort of transit providers or network providers or DNS providers doing that access. But the fact this was actually done on the application itself kind of suggests this was the only way it could have been blocked, because you could have got around it in sort of different ways unless you got the DNS providers to revoke the service and refuse to take that or serve it out from there, then you wouldn't have been able to pass it there. So what this kind of serves of is really a lesson, you know, is like, if you do have these situations, this is actually kind of a clean way of how do we sort of divert it. And we've seen it to a degree when you look at issues occurring when they redirect to a status page. So effectively, I go to a status page that says we're doing what we can to resolve it. You can even put information on that page, but all the while you're working on a patch update and this type of stuff. So it's a really kind of clean way to either update your service or to make changes in the back end to sort of bring stuff online.
I guess the only problem with moving your DNS is that when you do decide to bring it back online, it takes a while to propagate across all the different DNS servers. So you have to factor for that delay when you decide to go back live.
Yeah, 100%. This isn't a lights on, lights off situation. You've got that sort of hold down time. And this is basically what we saw effectively. I suspect what happened when it started to go down, everything was still held in cache. So people still knew how to get there. So we had the landing page, but the DNS was probably revoked around the same time, but it started to get there. And the same again when you had that time period picking up. But yeah, these are all things you have to take consideration. It's very similar to if I'm changing a route, I'm changing my prefix from a BGP perspective. There's going to be some sort of hold down timers, because obviously what you get in a situation, if I'm constantly changing and my DNS is there, then I get this situation where I could be flapping. So I'm, you know, it's over here, it's over there, it's over here, it's over there. And you get this instability in the environment. And that's the same, which is why these things exist. But absolutely, that propagation time has to be taken into consideration.
And that's our show. For more outage insights, tune in to our Top Outages of 2024 webinar, where we'll share lessons learned from some of the year's most notable outages. We've included the link in the description so you can check it out. Please give us a follow and leave us a review on your favourite podcast platform. We really appreciate it. And not only does this ensure you're in the know when a new episode's published, it also helps us to shape the show for you. You can follow us on LinkedIn or X at ThousandEyes, or send questions or feedback to internetreport@thousandeyes.com. Until next time, goodbye.